there's never been a better time to be in the private sector in healthcare. It is our time to stand up, to build, to contribute in any way possible to make people healthier. And so that's what we kind of wake up and think about every day is like, what can we uniquely do to massively transform healthcare? And there's a lot the private sector can be doing right now. I'm not saying it's easy, but there's a lot of white space for the private sector to play right now.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. From its founding in 2010, Rock Health has defined and popularized the term digital health. And since then, the organization has grown, expanded, and changed, but its early goal of creating a vibrant, interconnected, and inclusive digital health community continues. I sat down with Rock Health CEO Katie Drasser at Aspen Ideas Health to talk about how she and the organization are paving the way for even more innovation. She wants to fix the broken flywheel for women's health investing, imagine what a slow tech movement could look like, and focus on the outcomes we want, not just the returns we need. Just wanted to let you know we'll be taking a break in August, and we'll be back after Labor Day with a really special episode that will bring all of us a little more hope as we move into the fall. Please welcome Katie Drasser to The Other 80. I'm here with Katie Drasser. Here we are at Aspen Ideas Health, and she used to curate programming here. So excited to have you here.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Is there like a particular memory or thing that always comes back to you when you come on campus?
I mean, I do think one thing is you can't replicate the campus. So anything that happens here is just so distinct based on the natural environment we're in, which makes every conversation, every memory just so much more magical, I would say. And most of my memories are grounded certainly in some provocative content, but really in the relationships and the community, especially here at Aspen Ideas Health, that has been built over a decade, that is just, it's strong. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the in-between times, there's so much we all do together, but it's sort of grounded in a lot of what got started here.
I always like to start with, what do you think is really important to know about you?
I mean, as it relates to your podcast, which is so impressive, by the way, congrats on all of its success. I really love the conversations and the broader narrative that you're building out here at The Other 80. I would say that the way I define health is much broader than I think it gets defined in a lot of different spaces. Health really is architecture, it's design, it's all the things. What happens inside a doctor's office or inside of a hospital is just a fraction of what health is. And I'm not alone in this definition, but the idea that health is about being healthy, not about avoiding illness. And so when you really have that mindset, what you design, what you build, what you put your energy into is far broader, but hopefully longer term, like real systemic, sustainable change. When you think of health that way and not just in sort of the nitty gritty, narrow definition of health and healthcare, especially here in the U.S.
It'll be really fun to get into what that looks like from an investing and innovation perspective, because I think we tend to think of that as like the work of community-based organizations or of housing organizations, but don't really bring it back to this core accelerator layer, which is innovation and digital. So excited about that. You put out a really seminal piece of work over the last few months focused on women's health, and there's been a lot of attention, I think, to the really not good stats around the extent to which both women founders don't get funded, but also the extent to which women's health, the things that make us feel good on an everyday basis, are often ignored or shunted aside. So there's sort of this combined two pieces. And one of the analogies you used that I thought was so apt was the broken flywheel. And what I loved about that is it describes this as a system, and that in order to make a change, we can't just tweak here or tweak there. We actually have to think about the system. So could you please talk a little bit about what that broken flywheel looks like for women's health?
Absolutely. And you're right. I mean, thankfully, there's been a lot more attention, how that translates to dollars in action and all the things. We hope that follows. When we think about women's health, this here at Rock Health and, you know, U.S. domestically, women are the chief medical officers of their homes, of their communities. They spend 80% of the dollars. They're the primary caregivers, often in the family. They're the, like, uber users of health. And yet, there is such a disconnect because whether it's from a clinical standpoint, a research standpoint, a product design standpoint, broader innovation and then investment standpoint, they are so massively underfunded, overlooked, misunderstood as a category. And in fact, many people will say, and I agree with this, I think it's a misnomer to even call it a category. I think it's actually making it way too small. We don't say men's health, which is everything else that's happening. It's just health, but we're just not given the attention from any of those different angles to actually do right by the fact that women are these sort of chief medical officers of the home. And so when we think about the broken flywheel, we're specifically talking about venture dollars, which is actually a fairly small piece of the pie, but a really important piece of the pie. It's where a lot of the innovation gets, you know, sparked and tested. And then we're specifically talking about health tech and digital health. And the reason we even care about tech is that we think, and a lot of other people besides us here at Rock Health think this, that tech has an outsized role to play in serving people who haven't been served, in personalizing health, especially in this case for women, in ways that hasn't been done before that would actually increase health outcomes, moving farther faster. All those reasons, we don't care about tech just because we care about tech. We care about tech because it could solve for these things. And so then when you look at what gets invested in at that intersection, we've been encouraged from 2020 to 2024, $4.4 billion in venture funding has gone to women's health companies or products or service lines. And actually in 2024, the most recent year, we have data on $671 million has gone into women's health, which is the highest percentage point in recent years of the slice of venture funding. That's great. It is still a tiny, tiny fraction. And so when you look at why that is, that's 6.6% of the funding, and that's the highest proportion in recent years. Why is that? There's something broken. So this gets to the broken flywheel. What is broken is a few things. One, from an investment standpoint, you have investors who do a one-and-done approach. One and done. We already invested in that quote-unquote category, which again, should we be even calling it a category? And so they think they've made one investment and then they don't touch it again. And these are some of these are giant funds that actually control the bulk of the dollars in venture. You also have a lot of emerging fund managers who can actually invest in later stage growth companies because their dollars and contributions really are better suited in the size of earlier stage investments. So there's sort of a cliff, one could argue, after Series B or so, where there's just not that much funding coming after that. So that's another part of this broken flywheel. And then there's just like a lot of these companies are founded by women. Women are chronically underfunded. That needle has hardly moved in recent years. One thing that I always like to, people say, well, are there enough women? One of the most fun parts about healthcare and health in the US in this startup, you know, innovation ecosystem space, we know from Rock Health data that at least 50% of the founders in this space are women. So we're here and building really cool things, and we're still only getting, you know, less than 5% of the dollars, and our check sizes are quite small in comparison. All of that contributes to this broken flywheel, I would say.
Let's imagine you could get all of the leading investors in a room and you had an hour with them. Is there a piece of evidence? Because moral arguments, you should be investing in women.
The business case,
like, who cares? So what facts would you put in front of them to say, this is ridiculous, you're leaving money on the table?
I think I would go back to women being the uber users of healthcare. And so we ran data recently, our consumer adoption survey, which is census matched. And we looked at how women are using digital health. And about 53% are using digital health tools. Well, then when you compare that to men, it's about the same. And then we go, well, wait a minute, men are not the baseline. If we are 80% of the dollars and the uber users, the chief medical officers, the primary caregivers in our homes and communities, then that number should be way higher. So there's a business opportunity there. There is a lot of demand on the table that is not being accounted for, that a lot of these companies and ones we haven't even heard of yet, that don't exist yet, could be attracting. I could go further than that, but that to me is like one of the biggest ones, is just how sizable the market is. And I think we massively undercalculate and underestimate the size of the market over and over and over again.
One of the things I was talking about last year with Renee Wegerzin from ARPA-H was the exciting women's health effort that was going on at ARPA-H. And I think partly that was being inspired by Jill Biden. To some extent, policy certainly shapes the opportunity space. And when you have a big White House platform, that's great. To what extent do you see this change of administration affecting the progression and acceleration that you were describing?
We often like to think about what's the innovation ecosystem that all these things are being built off of, right? And we talked earlier about research and clinical advancements and all kinds of innovation, product, et cetera. The government is a really important part of the foundation of this innovation ecosystem. So the work that comes out of NIH, a lot of people in all sectors, but certainly in healthcare, use to build companies off of, to pilot innovations, products, et cetera. There's some really impressive work that's been done over the years, largely out of NIH, but some other parts of the government around women's health, for instance. And really, since women were left out of clinical trials and were left out of a lot of research for years and years, this is now new longitudinal data that helps all of us figure out, okay, where's the demand? Where's the need? What's important about whatever we're building? As those programs and research projects get halted, stopped, whatever it is, we're losing really valuable data that's not just from the last year. And you can't just pick up again in the future. What gaps is it leaving in the innovation ecosystem? On the flip side, you know, we work in the private sector, and with a lot of folks in the private sector, there's never been a better time to be in the private sector in healthcare. It is our time to stand up, to build, to contribute in any way possible to make people healthier. And in this case, women, but everybody. And so that's what we kind of wake up and think about every day, is what can we uniquely do to massively transform healthcare? And there's a lot the private sector can be doing right now. I'm not saying it's easy, but there's a lot of white space for the private sector to play.
One thing I really love about your personal focus and that of Rock Health is not shying away from the messy, hard problems that are really what often are the line between health and not health. And that's reinforced by data that shows that the drivers behind our lower life expectancy are really the conditions and deaths of despair around mental health, suicide, violence, overdose, things of that nature. Certainly, there's been innovation in that space. And I'm really curious to know, what are some specific approaches you're seeing in the digital health space that go after some of those drivers of why we're not living as long of a life as those in Europe and other countries?
I love this question. One of the things, you know, we were just talking about women's health. Another thing we're pretty obsessed with, I would say. We get obsessed with things. We're obsessed with behavioral health and really especially youth mental health right now. One, because one in five adults live with a mental health condition. In the case of kids, you know, one in five children experiences a mental or an emotional, you know, behavioral disorder. It's the second leading cause of death among teens. It's astounding. It is literally affecting the physical health of young adults, you know, kiddos and adults. All kinds of mental health challenges right now, right? Where we have seen a lot of hope and opportunity is a whole set of leaders, so investors, you know, innovators of all kinds, entrepreneurs, and others who are raising their hand to get in the ring on this, build a company, fund a company, partner, et cetera. It's so life-giving to watch this sector collaborate and build. From an investment standpoint, behavioral health has been the number one funded area over the last 7 years of all venture funding in healthcare in the U.S.
I have no idea.
Further, youth mental health has grown from, of that pie, 15 to 34% is now funding youth mental health of all those behavioral health investments. So there's the moral case. Everybody buys the moral case. Nobody is immune to a mental health disorder. And certainly there are supports and things that make it easier for some to be healthier, and some makes it harder for others, right? Of course, systemic issues, et cetera. But this affects everybody. We know it affects, for instance, employers. Of parents who work, 1 in 5 miss one day a month for their child's mental health. So if you're a working parent, 1 in 5 will miss a day a month for their child's mental health. That's astounding. That's not your own health. That's not your kid's physical health. That's your kid's mental health. So it's affecting, it's literally affecting everybody in this country in some fashion, teachers, you know, everybody. And so we've seen a tremendous amount of opportunity there, both from this investment angle, but then in terms of what's working, you asked about, okay, so what solutions are you seeing? I think one of the ones we find most exciting is some of the best companies in this space have kids at the table.
I love
helping
that.
To design these innovations. And in fact, our advice to investors is, if you're going to invest in a youth mental health company, you better make sure that they have some sort of youth panel. Youth are at the table during product design, during model design. They're weighing in and giving feedback. That is going to make that company so much better and stronger. One example of a company that we get excited about, for instance, is Mindrite. Ashley is amazing. We love her company. At the heart of it is like texting with kids. And, you know, there's a big narrative right now that tech is bad. And I think that narrative needs to be dismantled a little bit. It is causing a lot of problems, for sure. Social media, all the rest. Tech is also helping in a lot of ways, and we need to pay attention to where it is. So in the case of Ashley and Mindrite, kids like to text. It's quiet. They can do it on the couch next to somebody they might not want to share whatever it is they're texting. They can be in a space that they're able to actually access services. And because it is sort of like repetitive and daily that you can be texting with your mental health coach or peer coach, when there is something acute, you're already there. They're already there. Whereas a lot of other interventions are very episodic.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Mindrite, and there's other companies like this, they're building a relationship over time. And it may just be a simple text. And let's not discount that as unimportant. That is the drumbeat so that when there is something, you know, acute or more episodic, that service has been established, that relationship, that point of care, that support that that kid might feel is already there to catch them and to be there. And so there's a lot of companies like Mindrite and others who are doing this kind of thing and kind of playing with, like, they got that idea from kids. Some folks of a different generation, is it texting? Like, how is that going to help? Well, in this case, it does. It's what kids ask for. And then that's their demand. They're meeting their demand. It's actually working. So, yeah.
I remember one of my friends was on the board of Crisis Text Line. And one of the other exciting things about text, which has to be managed with a lot of care.
Absolutely.
Is how much you can learn about what works and actually say, oh, look, in this interaction, that really worked, but this kind of thing really didn't work. And have feedback loops that are, I think, a lot easier than other formats and other forms where you can really build in the response of the users and try to make it more supportive of them. One of the things we were talking about when you came in is a retreat I recently hosted in the woods. And part of the idea was to get people out of their regular environments and make connections surrounded by nature and in this much more abundant feeling kind of way. And I was thinking about, you know, the slow food movements, the slow travel movements. But when we think about digital tools and technology, we think of it as moving fast. But I'm curious, what would a slow digital tech company look like, one that prioritizes long-term impact, patient trust, and equity over the long term? So bring us into this slow tech company. How would it approach the work in a different way than we've seen in the past?
You know, I do think some companies are doing this. They may not be calling it that, but I think there is a tension with the speed and scale that venture requires. And when you look at health tech, that's often the dollars we're applying to these innovations. And so I think the first thing I would start with is fundamentally changing the funding model for innovation in healthcare and really massively widening the aperture about how we think about that, and that every company could have a set of blended finance supporting whatever it is they're building in a way that resources those companies for what they need in that moment and as they grow. And I would imagine venture would be a part of that journey, but not the whole part of the funding pie. And I think that shift in funding would really change some of the markers and the metrics so that you could be a quote-unquote slow tech company like the Slow Food Movement and others. So that would be like the first thing I would say. What would you then do with different dollars? So I think you would really ground these innovations in community and trust. So less about transaction, less about users, and more about community, more about trust. That would be the first thing that I think would be different, which would then bleed into design. You know, how things get designed wouldn't be, sure, you know, rapid prototyping is often the gold standard. Well, sometimes the rapid prototyping misses what you learn from a community and the inputs needed to like get off on the right foot. And so I would think of the design behind these innovations as far more participatory and not as top down. So trust, not transactional. Design is participatory. We talk a lot about adoption of these things. I would more meaningfully measure the adoption as not just downloads or signups, but rather like, is someone's health actually getting better? How are they engaging? What does engagement look like? How do we make that and measure that in a more meaningful way? And in terms of equity, I mean, I would put that right into the business model in ways that not all companies can afford to do. It can be expensive to have equity in the model. And then I would just have learning built into the operating model, like a constant culture of learning to make these products and models and delivery mechanisms as excellent as possible. So I think like these would be some of the markers and the principles of a slow tech company. We often celebrate in our space how much a company has raised. And I would love for us to celebrate how many lives saved or how, you know, lives made better, et cetera, which I think ultimately could come out of the kind of movement you're talking about.
Let's imagine us back in that room with all those investors describing this alternative model. Would they be excited or a little skeptical? It's not to say they have to buy onto it altogether, because you could get foundations, you could get non-dilutive government funding, you could get impact investing, right? But still, at some point, those things have to work together in an ecosystem. What reactions do you think you'd get to that? Or maybe you've already tried it.
We collaborate often with a range of investors and a range of capital, and I would say there'd be a ton of excitement. You don't get into healthcare investing, the ones who have been here a while and have stay, just for the money. Certainly, there's money to be made in this space. That's part of the model. There's far easier sectors to invest in. And so I actually think some investors would feel relief that there are other types of supports to resource the things they also care about, but can't always move their dollars in that way. Some investors are hamstrung more than people might realize in the way they can move their dollars and towards what, you know, and who they have to answer to and the metrics they have to meet. Fair enough, that's the model. Okay. But most of those investors, I think, would be pretty enthusiastic about different inputs to support the best healthcare innovation possible. You know, if something's not working, it's actually not all that innovative.
No. You know, we've had a couple IPOs recently and everyone's watching them with bated breath and looking at the ups and the downs and trying to figure out what it all means. I think what it means, though, that is there have been successful exits, but that they took a long time to get there. If we can use that funding to also create a longer runway where you don't have to show tech scale success in the first 2 years, you're not going to be able to accomplish all those things you described in 2 years. It's going to take a lot longer than that. I've seen some examples of foundations doing impact investing. One thing I see, though, is it comes in as additional on top of the VC, but in the round. And so the weight of that as an influence on the direction of the companies can be quite small. Maybe it's a way to ask for a slightly different market play or go to market or whatever, I think there's some things that can be asked. So I'm also curious about how those would need to be sequenced. So you're not coming in with an extra $500,000 on a $10 million round. There just has to be a way that that voice can be stronger. And I don't know what that looks like.
I think there's a lot of ways to think about that. And depending on the innovation and what's required, I mean, we see far too many leaders and entrepreneurs, CEOs, companies pretzeling themselves to fit the funding. I think it's high time that the funding fits the good idea and the funding fits the innovation, which is something we would love to see and we spend a lot of time on. I do think when equity is baked in from the start in a real way, it is easier to maintain over time. And so I think some early dollars that are really hard for a lot of founders to get would actually have an outsized impact because it would fundamentally shape the innovation, the model, the company, et cetera. You know, there's that theory, the curb cut theory. Like if you design for the most marginalized, if you design for the most overlooked, it's actually better for everybody. And so I think some of this is how might we design for those that are the most left out and actually the folks that are always included would benefit too, right? And adding that later is a lot harder. I think a lot of people think, let's do the most basic thing first and we'll layer all that in. I think if you start with that, and my hope is, you know, for one of these slow tech companies, as you're calling them, that that would be a way to do business that would actually generate great returns and great health outcomes and et cetera.
One of my favorite meetings from my time in the health innovation space was with Sean Duffy right after he finished the Rock Health program. It literally was in some like lobby in Union Square somewhere. And at that time, Rock Health was kind of a more traditional accelerator model. And you've really evolved since then. I'm curious, what are some of the new directions you've taken as the incubator and holder of this space that might not have been evident back when Sean was first in the program?
Yes. Congrats to Sean for all of his recent success. You know, when you were talking earlier about these IPOs, I do think a lot of people, and you could say this about a few of these early digital health companies, a lot of other entrepreneurs have benefited from the paths that have been paved by people like Sean and the really impressive work that Omada has done, which I think could, and we're already seeing, will shape the speed and the ability to build in this space for a long time. In terms of the evolution, I think if our vision and mission is to massively transform healthcare, then what are all the levers we can pull to get there? An accelerator model is one of them, for sure. We do a lot of work at Rock Health with enterprises, sort of figuring out what is their digital health strategy? What might that look like? So we have a ton of, we have a membership program, these ongoing relationships with the very people and companies that are buying these innovations. That has evolved since the early days and is really fun because the, you know, the matchmaking we get to do and the pulse we have on different parts of the ecosystem, the theory is that a lot of folks can benefit from that. There's a lot that can happen from our community and that connection. And so I would say in many ways, we've just grown from where we've started. It just looks a lot and is a lot bigger than the early days. Both the community, I mean, and the digital health space has changed a lot. We're often like credited with popularizing the term digital health. But really now, I mean, the whole space has changed. There's seasoned talent in this space that are onto their, you know, second, third, fourth spin at something cool. There's folks that were very junior back in 2011 that are now CEOs of companies and running different parts of corporations. I mean, it's pretty cool to watch. And so I would say we've evolved as the space has evolved. And our goal and our job is to stay a couple steps ahead and see around the corner to figure out how we can keep paving the way for more and better innovation to massively transform healthcare.
Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you so much, Claudia.
I look forward to running into you tomorrow and on Wednesday.
Sounds great. Thanks again for having me. I love your podcast. And this is fun stuff to talk about, so I appreciate it.
I'm pretty captivated by this idea of a slow tech approach to health. And I've been thinking about the other slow models that have preceded it. Slow travel, which prioritizes deep connection and engagement over quick, superficial interactions. or slow food that centers quality over speed and prioritizes ethical production? Or what about slow fashion's commitment to emphasize durability and fair labor practices? The through lines are building around value, durability, connection, and minimal negative impact. And so a slow approach to health would do the same. It would ground innovation in lived experience. It would prioritize relationships and autonomy. It would remain firmly grounded in place and community. So what would it take for all of us to slow down a little? How could we adopt a more mindful and intentional approach to how we use tech and investments to foster health innovation? Should we give this a try? This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Katie Drasser and Rock Health. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.